Thanks to Bombfell for supporting FilmSack. Bombfell is an online personal styling service for men that helps find the right clothes for you. Get $25 off your first purchase at bombfell.com/filmsack. That's bombfell.com/filmsack.
EWA 517, do you want to report a UFO? Over.
Negative. We don't want to report.
Ares 31, do you wish to report a UFO? Over.
Negative. We want to report one of those either.
Ares 31, do you wish to file a report of any kind? Over.
I wouldn't know what kind of report to file, Senator.
Ares 31, me neither. I'll try to track traffic to destination. Over.
That mattress, you've got to destroy that mattress.
This is FilmSack. Oh, sure.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to FilmSack. This is FilmSack, mining the very depths of film entertainment for all mankind. Episode 400. 400. We celebrate today by doing a regular episode of the show. My name is Scott Johnson. Joining me today, Brian, there's a dead fly in my potatoes. Dunaway.
There's too many potatoes. It's killing the flies. Greetings, Earthlings. We are here for the Shark Slayer. The one your people call Dreyfus. Ah, there he is now. Good, good. He received our mind mail. There were concerns about compatibility. We discussed sending a DM via social media, but that is still decades or more away. Spoiler, it changes everything. With great power comes great responsibility. Hashtag Excelsior. Anywho, the ladies up here have authorized me to offer you a trade for these 100 totally not Shark Slayers for your one Dreyfus. Shark Slayer 100%. Excellent. It would appear the trade has pleased the Dreyfus. So suck it. And thank you, people of Earth, for your sacrifice. The universe will love you long time. Am I saying that correctly? Now to space, where we'll engage the great space shark in a battle we will call Jaws X. Little title, Dreyfus in Space. Oh, wait. Almost forgot. Dreyfus, would you like to say goodbye to anyone? No? Perhaps your wife and kids?
No.
No?
No.
You sure? Damn, you one cold-hearted shark slayer. What's that, Dreyfus? Scheider slayed the shark. You just poked it with a stick. Well, we got what we got.
Yeah.
Someone give this human a stick to space.
He's going to need a new ship, he'd say.
Right. Pilot, play that funky beat.
Very nice. Oh, wait, is there more?
Is that it?
Oh, okay. Well done. That was good. Also with us.
Are you tired now?
No, I'm good. Everything's good.
I'm exhausted.
We have Randy, don't mind me, just going to shovel a load of dirt into the kitchen window, Jordan.
A-L-O-H-A. 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 My friends. Brian Dunaway, Brian Ibbett, Scott Johnson. Thank you for 400 episodes. Thank you for the last 9 years. Thank you for taking me into your spaceship of fun and giving all the people out there half-face burns. Sick half-face burns. I know. You're feeling the last 9 years, and you're getting old. But look at me. I haven't aged a day.
That's amazing.
True.
You're beautiful.
Walked off that ship.
R-A-N-D-Y-Y-Y. Y-Y-Y-D-Y-Y-Y.
The remix.
Oh, my gosh. Close Encounters of the Nerd Kind. Hey, here's the final thing here. Brian, your truck has too much shud in it. Ibbit.
No kidding. Clean that truck.
Yeah.
All right. So we figured out that Close Encounters of the First Kind is when you see a UFO.
Right.
Close Encounters of the Second Kind is if you experience an event caused by the UFO, like noise, rattling, shaking, whatever, mailboxes going chung, 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 all that stuff.
Yeah.
Third kind, of course, is seeing the actual alien in there. And there have been extensions of that list. For example, the fourth kind is being abducted. The fifth kind is having some form of communication with an alien. In recent years, they've added to the list. For example, Close Encounters of the Sixth Kind is getting a text or an email from an alien within 3 days of abduction saying they had a good time and they'd like to abduct you again. Close Encounters of the Seventh Kind is a late night text from the alien, which simply says, "Hey, you up?" and leads to yet another anal probe booty call.
Great.
Oh!
And then Close Encounters of the Eighth Kind is them wanting to meet you at a public place like a Starbucks so they can tell you that they never want to abduct you again and you won't make a scene because it's a public place. You just cry into your half-calf double whip extra hot grande pumpkin spice latte. Wow. Don't worry. It's not you. It's them.
Oh, my gosh.
Is there a limit to the Eighth Kind? Because I've been there twice this week.
Two times this week.
And what would Close Encounters of the Rule 34 kind
Oh, we don't want to know. We don't want to know. It's Jesus. Too close of an encounter.
I'm sure there's a video.
Probably. Probably. In fact, there's probably a porn parody of this film, as far
That's
as we know.
That's what I'm saying, yeah.
Oh my gosh, gotta be.
Well, the movie is Close Encounters
Closeless
of the Third Kind.
Closeless Encounters.
Yes, there you go. Closeless Turd Encounters. Kind. Turd Kind. Ooh, wait. That kind of movie is bad. I don't want that movie.
The Cleveland Steamer Spaceship Edition.
Great, yeah. Great. This is a movie. It's an old one, and it's one that has a long history of people admiring it and ripping it off and making things in their movies that are kind of similar in some ways, and kind of a big deal for Steven Spielberg, I think, in his career, because it was him saying, all right, I don't just make scary shark movies, everybody. I make other stuff that's like kind of feel good, weird, spacey kind of stuff. And he'd go on to do E.T. not long after this. And it's probably the only other one that's truly in the space stuff would be, what, AI? I can't think of anything else.
Right. Oh, yeah. Minority Report. How can you not forget
that? Well, that was not really
space. It's just future.
Right.
Future. Yeah. Like in space.
It's also based on
batteries not included.
Like there's no oxygen.
Your aliens.
Yeah, but he didn't direct that. We always forget that.
Produced
it.
Oh, he just produced it. That's right.
It's all. Yeah. Don't worry. Everyone on this planet thinks he directed that movie.
Yeah.
He actually gets royalties because of some
loophole glitch in the system says that he should get money.
You say that, and he does do production, but he's not a hands-off producer kind of guy. So he definitely has a big influence.
He may have. Who knows on that one though? By then he was sleeping in money. I don't know if he needed to worry about getting up early and get down there, make sure
this money is uncomfortable.
Yeah,
is there a theory out there that the shark from Jaws is actually an alien?
Whoa.
Yes.
Sure, why not? I really like the idea of putting all of his directed movies into the same universe, but it gets real hard when you have this same person, like Richard Dreyfuss in those two very different movies. You know what I mean? Like that gets hard. But when you get away from that, things like Lincoln, Indiana Jones movies, it's great. They all fit together.
Okay, quick trivia. Who can answer me the fastest? What's the third movie Richard Dreyfuss was in, directed by Steven Spielberg? Go.
Oh, interesting. That's a good question.
We've talked about it before. We've never seen it here, but we've talked about it. And I'll give you a hint.
Mr. Holland Opeth.
No, it's not that.
Bridge of Spies?
Nope. It's less recent, but newer than the old stuff. Newer than this thing, obviously.
Wow.
Was it just a cameo?
Nope. Big role. John
really?
Goodman.
Oh, then it had to be Trippendorf's. Tribe.
Nope.
What is that?
It was Trippendorf's tribe. What the hell are you talking about?
What was it?
Krippendorf's tribe.
Krippendorf's tribe.
Wasn't that
he did where he got half naked?
It had John Goodman in it. It had Holly Hunter in it. And no, nothing. Oh man, I'm surprised. The movie is called Always. You remember the airplane?
Of course.
He was like a ghost.
He dies
in
the first 2 minutes of the film.
Yeah, but he's in the rest of it. It's like Ghost.
I know. I'm kidding.
It's like Ghost.
I forgot about that. I forgot that was a Spielberg joint.
Yeah, it was a Spielberg, quiet Spielberg movie.
Spielberg.
Yeah. I found it really, really hard to not just think of only Steven Spielberg while watching this film. Like, he is so like singular in terms of both writing and directing and deciding every little decision, like you really just can't assign any of it to anyone else. And that's something that still happens all the time, right? We see these filmmakers who are very singular, and they make the whole movie. Mm-hmm. But it, like, looking at something this big and expansive, like, it's like you almost forget that John Williams scored the music. You're like, oh wow, Steven Spielberg made a great musical decision there. You know, that mm-hmm. that kind of thing.
Yeah,
and which, John Williams made it very difficult to pick the best sooundtrack doing this movie and Star Wars so close together. It's
it's really good. The soundtrack in this thing is really amazing. Good. Yeah, it's one of my favorites.
Really quick, back to Always. Did that come out before or after Ghost?
I don't know. It feels like right around the same time in my head.
It does feel like it.
Feels like it came out the same year as Crocodile Dundee. Could have been. Did it do that for some reason?
Could have been. It was definitely I'll tell you what it felt like. It felt like when he did Amazing Stories on TV. I feel like it was one that they just couldn't get in. They're like, we can't squeeze this one in. Sorry, Steven. The season's done and we're canceled. All right, well, I'll make a movie called Always, and it'll be that.
Yeah, I mean, it was certainly believable that it was a story that they originally planned for Amazing Stories. Said, oh no, this is way much. We could make such a much bigger thing out of this, a 2-hour thing.
Yeah, it's definitely that gimmick, though, right? Like, it's like, here's this guy, he dies in a plane crash. Now he's alive for the rest of the movie, and no one else can see him, or however it worked. I don't remember how the movie went.
Don't forget, you can watch The Amazing Stories on NBC.com for free right
now. That's fantastic.
Oh, cool. 22 episodes.
It was on Netflix for a while, and that's not there anymore.
It was. Nope.
If you do, by the way, if you do that, the one you want to watch is also airplane related. It's the cartoonist in the belly of the plane.
Yeah, that one was really good. All of them are really great. Ghost Train, the first one, was really good as well. The Mission, I think, is the one you're thinking about.
That thing changed my life. Like, literally changed my course of my life, that movie.
Yeah.
Or that short. Whatever that was, whatever the magic was there, that's when I decided I was going to draw for the rest of my life. And here's the other thing. That cast included Kiefer Sutherland, who we just saw in Young Guns. The captain on that thing was freaking, oh my gosh, Waterworld. Help me.
Kevin Costner.
Kevin Costner was the captain.
Help me.
And there are like two or three other dudes in there. You're just like, oh my gosh, these guys are about to have these like huge career shifts. And they're all in this little short.
Zanesco. You know what's funny is I always confuse the cast of this with the cast of Memphis Belle, because that was another movie where the gunner was trapped in the bulb at the bottom of the plane.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
you're right.
Had a big popular cast, and
this movie, Close Encounters, confused its own cast with nothing. I was shocked at the beginning of the film when it tells you that it stars Richard Dreyfuss and Francois Truffaut, and you're like, and that's it?
Yeah,
wait, what?
Pretty much that's your cast.
That's the whole cast. Because I felt like Terry Garr, Melinda Dillon, and Bob Balaban were very important.
I agree. 100% agree. And also, just, two things about the people you just mentioned. Terry Garr, still worthy of a 2018 crush. She's amazing. I freaking love her.
She was,
yes.
I had the biggest crush on her in everything she was ever in.
And this was peak form Terry Garr. Like, this was the most crushable Terry Garr.
Yeah, the most crushable worthy. But no, but she also wanted to, she actually wanted to play the character
that
he was not running away from. Yeah, he wanted to play the Jillian.
The Melinda Dillon.
I can see that. She was, Melinda Dillon's character she was nominated for a Best Supporting Actress role for that, and I think she was pretty damn good.
I made the mistake to say Dillon. It is just Dillon.
Is it Dillon? I always say Dillian too. Is it Dillon?
I know. Melinda Dillon.
Okay. Melinda Dillon.
There you go. Melinda Dillon.
But she was quite good. I think the weakest performance, I'm not saying he's a bad actor, but I think the weakest performance is probably Dreyfuss's. I think he's a little over the top in this thing.
I actually like that. I liked that Richard Dreyfuss was so messed up. And Richard Dreyfuss will tell you in his initial viewing of the film that he was not pleased with his performance. But I actually liked it. I thought it was a man obsessed Richard Dreyfuss.
And that is the thing. He has to kind of play it over the top to make it believable that he's being kind of controlled by an unseen force, right?
Didn't it feel like he got the whole email? He got the whole email except the subject line. That's how it always felt to me. Like, he got the whole email that said, hey, it's a big structure. Make it out of potatoes and then try to do it out of shit in your house and then try to make it out of whatever. Make it out of
mud.
Why did
he have to do it inside? He could have done that outside.
He could have done it anywhere. Yes, but the point is, like, he got the email and he went to town, and if he just would have paid attention to the subject line, he would have said, it has like a cut-off flat top and now we're done. Right. Like, that was his big hang-up. It was like something glitched in the Matrix for him. It's a very odd thing. And if you think about it too hard, that stuff's kind of broken. Like, why could she, the lady with the son,
She gets flashed with the light, and so what does she do? Makes lovely, lovely drawings of it.
Drawings, sure. Yeah. Well, you know, if you're a sculptor, I guess Richard Dreyfuss wasn't really a sculptor either, but he could make a pile of shit.
Yeah, and then he,
Richard, it's a pile of potatoes or a pile of.
At one point, I mean, it's at any point, Richard Dreyfuss just needs to see a lump of something, and then he becomes transfixed, so, and he starts scooping poo out of a public toilet and making a mountain out of it, like. He has the worst version of this. It's terrible
for
him.
But he also got the greatest amount of exposure. He was already a dreamer, right? Because they've kind of established that from the beginning. So I still buy it.
Mm. I want to jump back to something you may not have known. Terry Garr retired in 2011.
Yeah.
Mm.
And went really, really private. She was always a fairly private person. Mm-hmm. Refused to answer intimate questions about herself and this kind of thing, all the way up to and including how old she is. Her actual birth date it has been unknown, publicly. There are records that people claim to have unearthed about her birth date, but those records disagree with each other, and she will probably die managing to keep the world from knowing precisely.
That's because she's never going to die, and she's always existed. And so
it's really remarkable when you look back through her Wikipedia edits, which I did for no reason. As you go back, different people throw in different sources for her birth date. They all agree she was born on December 11th, but the range jumps around between 1944 and 1949,
five-year difference.
Yeah, they really don't know. So it's assumed that she is 73. It's assumed that when she made this film, she was about 32. But she has done a tremendous job of never letting the world know how old she is.
That's amazing, because you'd think that something would leak out at some point where that would come out.
Mm-hmm. But it's smart, because she's from old Hollywood, and age was a big factor.
I don't know about old Hollywood. I'd call her...
Hollywood?
I mean,
old Hollywood would be like your Humphrey Bogart and your
I wouldn't even say Mel Brooks is from old Hollywood. He's influenced by it, right? But he's in his 90s and he's not.
And he's
old
responsible
Hollywood.
For one of her best roles too, which was Young Frankenstein.
Yeah, she was great.
Frankenstein,
so good.
She was really good in that. But she just, I don't know, something about her. She's got some sweetness
to her. Like it's Goldie Hawn without the bimbo.
Yeah, or the complete brainlessness of
I want to bring it around in a circle here. This film not only didn't know that it had these people in it like Terry Garr, but it felt to me like the film didn't really care. Like these are characters that I really wanted just a little more development around, and I didn't get it. Like imagine what it would actually do to a person to have their toddler constantly running away and then ultimately disappear. Like, that's a really interesting thing that I just felt like I didn't get a lot of.
No, there was my other opening was going to be something like, Close Encounters, the story of a boy named Barry who desperately wants to get away from his mother.
Yeah.
I was going to do the same thing, except it was about Dreyfuss's character, who Roy really wanted to get away from his family, because that's what it is about the end, because there's no question, chick in the bucket.
Oh my gosh, the entire family, big old chick in the bucket, man.
Right. They're like a big old KFC 12-piece style chick in the bucket.
Well, and that home with the kids and their home life reminded me of why I didn't like E.T. Mm. And it was like, I recognized Steven Spielberg's pretty good at this. Like, this feels very realistic.
Yeah.
But I didn't, I just didn't like that like frantic constant thing where all the kids are banging around and always into pranks and stuff.
Because you've
times.
Only got it's one
like,
kid.
Yeah.
Right. No, it just
Scott could probably speak to the fact that if you've got three young kids, those kids.
I actually kind of like it, because there's an energy to it, and I respond to it in a positive way. Like when I'm watching this, I was like, yeah, this is how this can be. And it has this effect of like, this is not the time of your lives to own a decent piece of furniture. And this is not the time of your life to have a good TV, because the kids are going to put Pop-Tarts in the VCR. They're going to do weird stuff like that. And I have nothing but fond feelings for that time, for that era of raising three similarly aged kids. And so for me, I see this and it's nothing but positive, but I totally get it. I totally get how this looks like chaos to anybody else, and I don't blame them.
Well, and it just looks like a very, very particular cultural slice that nowadays, through my 2018 eyes, I look at and go, it's not very accessible. And I hate to jump all the way to the end of the movie, but it's really, really weird to me. At the end of the movie, you have all these humans standing around, and they're all different shapes and sizes. Yeah. And the aliens come out, and they're all exactly the same. And I'm just like, man, Spielberg, get some imagination, buddy.
Well, they had the one. What? What'd you say?
Inbreeding.
Oh, inbreeding. Nice. But I noticed they were the one that came out with those spindly arms or whatever.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know what the deal there is. And that's part of what I like about the movies. It doesn't explain anything.
He was their king.
There's a more practical answer to why that one is different. It's they had so much footage to edit from the end of the film, and they had decided to go one way with most of the aliens, but they had tried puppets at one point in time, and so they had filmed some puppetry, and that's where the spindly came along, but they didn't think it really worked well, but they still needed to be
worked hard enough that at least wanted to use the one.
Right. So that's the reason why it feels this way.
It would have been so good if all the aliens came out and they were that kind of weird spider limb kind of looking.
Yeah, and that's what you'd probably see today, probably. Somebody
if you're a advanced species that can master space travel and all that stuff and being able to zip down the highways going, 90 miles an hour, wouldn't you come up with a way out of your spaceship that doesn't require you basically to get down on your hands and knees to crawl out of.
Yeah. There's some practicality stuff there. But one of the things I like about the movie and always have always liked, and I even liked in this reviewing, is this sense that whether they were decided on for practical reasons or whatever the reasons they decided on, whatever ended up in the final footage, it all feels a little weird and hard to explain. And I like that.
Yes.
I like that. I like that in a movie where they're not afraid to not explain everything to me. They don't need to. These are very different. Clearly these are different cultures, different universes, really. And you've got no need to make them too relatable. And Spielberg is actually, I think, one of his faults in a lot of movies after this fails on that point. He makes it too relatable by the end, and it's like, okay, we get it. You want to touch our heartstrings and whatever. And this movie, I feel like he held back a bit and just left it up to us to figure it out. And whether that was intentional or not, I don't know, but I appreciate it.
Did everybody watch this on Netflix?
Yeah.
Yes.
Did they show the inside of the space?
No, it's not the special edition, which is a bummer because I was really hoping it was the special edition. I remember seeing that once.
Right.
I persuaded my dad to go sit through this movie a second time because they had re-released the special edition, which you don't think of that in this day and age with John Cameron releasing 48 different versions of Terminator 2. The special edition was released in theaters 4 or 5 months after the first theatrical release.
Right.
And so everybody had to go back to the theater to watch the same movie again just to see the extra scenes.
Yeah,
and it's a whole different time for stuff like that.
And tell me the difference. It was just some interior shots of the ship.
Yeah, so Richard Dreyfuss walks around the inside of the ship for a little bit. Funny because something said that there was the ship in the desert. Wasn't the ship in the desert? Did I miss the ship in the desert in the version that we watched?
There wasn't a ship in the desert.
No, it wasn't. Yeah. Okay. It wasn't. Yeah,
it was just the planes. Right. Yeah. The airplanes that were there that were untouched or whatever the deal was.
Yeah.
They weren't real clear about that either. But again, I don't know. Something about that I appreciate. But
So multiple versions. The one and the reason why we're like, which did we see is because they eventually started putting out multiple versions in the same issue. Like the Laserdisc issue had two different versions of the film. Hmm. They made this whole special edition for the 20th anniversary, which I guess would have been 97, and so on. But ultimately, in 2001, he was like, all right, I finally reached a point in my life where I understand what I want to be the final cut. And he made a final cut. He got rid of a lot of the extra scenes that he had added back over the years. And that included seeing the interior of the ship, which he felt was too revelatory. That included the thing in the Gobi Desert, which he felt was too much. It was banging you over the head with what was going to happen, and he wanted the film to be a lot more mysterious as it builds. I was just like, I wanted to ask you, Scott, like, It's real easy to forgive this film for desperately needing an editor.
Yeah.
And I was like, why am I so forgiving of this film? I couldn't figure it out because I just saw Crimes of Grindelwald last night and it was like a later J.K. Rowling book.
Mm.
It was desperately needed an editor so bad. There were 30 minutes of stuff in that film that was just like such a drag, and I can't forgive it. I'm like, Crimes of Grindelwald, bad movie, too long, too much extra junk that doesn't do anything for me. And this film, I'm like, I'm riveted by the air traffic control scene.
I mean,
that's because Spielberg has the ability to create a vision that engages you.
I guess it's so. Just, I mean, Nick saw that movie last night too. By the way, my 18-year-old, he came home and said the exact freaking thing. He says to me,
say it in a Randy voice?
No, but his words to me were, Dad, there's like 30 minutes of that movie that didn't need to be there. And I just thought,
wow.
So when Randy said that, I was like, oh my gosh, he's right on point there. But I didn't see it because I'd coughed all my way through it. And so I sold my ticket to somebody else.
I made the mistake of saying that the special edition came out 4 or 5 months after. It was actually 3 years. It came out in 1980. I thought I could have sworn it was really close to the regular.
I would have thought you was right, too. But because maybe he went back
really
and reshot.
Felt like it was close. Yeah.
He reshot pretty quick after because he wanted to edit it. Once they figured out it was doing well, he wanted to go back and do it like he wanted. And the studio said, yeah, but you got to do the spaceship on the inside.
Yeah, he could make all the calls. He can do that now, but back then, even then, he was still,
he single-handedly almost sunk the studio and then saved their bacon.
Yeah.
You're welcome.
Yeah, he was that guy. But to address Randy's point, Spielberg, for all his other qualities or things you like or don't like about him, he can do a drawn out and make it seem worth it. Like he can somehow take all of that extra time, because this is a long movie, and not have you at the end of it go, man, that was too long, or you should have cut this or cut that. It never really quite feels that way. Now you could argue, I know there are examples like Crystal Skull where the whole thing feels like it shouldn't exist. And there's, there's obviously going to be outliers, but I agree with that. And I think that his proteges, people like J.J. Abrams, Denis Villeneuve, however you say his name, those kind of directors share some of that, and that's why their movies don't feel overlong to me, even though if you're looking at the clock, they are. Specifically, I wanted to mention the connection here that I have between this movie and why I think I love Villeneuve's work so much. It is very similar. Like, I would argue Arrival... Mm-hmm. Arrival is almost not remake, but an attempt to say, hey, I'm going to kind of do what you did with Close Encounters, but I'm going to do it my own way. And I think that's what Arrival is. And Arrival is amazing.
Is it The Arrival or Arrival?
It's just Arrival, I think.
And I'd even throw... there are two different movies. I'd even throw Cuarón into this as well, because I feel like Gravity could have just as easily been a Spielberg.
Just imagine if this movie had a title, the name of the film was something like Contact or Gravity, like, because let's face it, this is a badly named movie. The name does not at all lead you to anything about the film that's artistic or whatever. I just want to also bring up Chris Columbus, man. He is the protege of proteges.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's a good example as well. But I love
Duffer Brothers.
I love that. I love that those guys and gals have all sort of figured out a way to carry that piece of the Spielberg thing forward, even if they don't know they're doing it. Like and I'm sure you could look back at directors before Spielberg, even those that inspired him. He always talks about Lawrence of Arabia being the greatest film ever made. You could probably look at that and find all kinds of Spielbergisms that he carried forward. So I'm sure that that's always true. People iterate, but if he's got one gift he's left filmmaking, it's that approach and their ability to take whatever time is necessary to tell the story. Whereas lesser directors, lesser storytellers, and certainly lesser editors can't figure out a way to do it. And they make 2-hour movies feel like 3.
Yeah,
and that's unfortunate. And I love that about this movie. This movie did never feel overlong to me. I watched it with my daughter. She loved it. We had a great time. I mean, it's not perfect. This is an old ass movie, and there's some issues.
I felt like there were definitely things that should have been cut out of almost every scene. lengths of time that were cut out of almost every scene. Give us a little bit more setup on the characters, but maybe we don't need to spend so much time walking around the desert before, you know, the people chanting finally say, oh, the sounds came from up there. And give us a little bit more explanation about why the hand gestures are important, you know, the sign language translation of the tones and things like that.
I really liked the expansiveness of the film from the start, and I actually wish there had been more of that. I wish there was more exotic locales where aliens were visiting barely. Mm-hmm. You know, like ultimately we end up spending a lot of time in Muncie, Indiana, which is, that's a real Hollywood centric way of doing things, right? The rest of the world is experiencing this. Now let's come to this, you know, mundane American place, and that's where we're going to go from
there. That's where the rubber meets the road. I mean, I like expansive, you know, ideas and shots, but to really relate, I have to be there. Otherwise, you're just watching ID4.
Well, and Carter made a really interesting point. I'm glad you brought that up. We're watching it, and it's the scene. You know, they've got this big facility set up right behind the mountain there now, and they've got all these plans to meet the aliens, and they're communicating with this music, and they don't really explain how they got from A to Z very well. Like, how did they know to even be ready there? Like,
you know what? Spielberg is no stranger to tropes.
Yeah,
And this guy loves some Hollywood geography. That's the name of that trope. Mm-hmm. There's literally a shot of Dreyfuss driving around in the dark, lost early on in the film in mm-hmm. Indiana, and you can see palm trees. And it's like,
oh, really?
Does Spielberg don't care?
Yeah.
No, you don't care. Spielberg don't care. But here's the thing: we're watching that scene, and she leans to me and she goes, you know what I like about this? I said, what? She goes, if this was just the government and scientists responding to this thing that they don't know if is a threat or a friendly attempt to communicate, this would be a boring movie. And I said, well, why isn't it? She says, because they just long enough spend time with those guys. And then now we're back in the rocks with sweaty, tired, dirty Dreyfuss and his newly made girlfriend.
So she noticed the sweat. Good.
Yeah, she noticed that it just got personal again, is what she noticed.
Right.
And she finds that to be really important, even though if you dissect this movie, them having an idea of where this is going to be located, drawing and sculpting and all that crap, really meant nothing. It seemed like the scientists and stuff all knew where to be and what to have. Like, why were they even involved?
They sure got that landing strip built quickly and like set up lights and stuff like that.
Right.
Balaban, you know, set that up because he's like, oh yeah, not only am I the most convenient French speaking person you have, I also am a cartographer, and let me school you on some stuff. And that's how they got there so quick, because they weren't touched. They weren't touched by the extraterrestrials. They were just lucky.
Yeah, but Scott's talking about something that really stuck in my craw, which is that the film tries to tell a story of a government sort of like suppressing the truth and speaking out of both sides of its mouth. Like there's literally two consecutive scenes where a bunch of locals are called into a meeting with government toughs who sit there and lie to them. And then you immediately cut to in a back room warehouse, the government is prepping people to go meet the aliens. And it's like you go from one to the other, and you're supposed to go, ooh, conspiracy. But the film doesn't really tell the story. Mm. It just shows you that.
Yeah.
And that's okay. It just could have been more to that intrigue, you know?
Yeah. And also, you know, you're right, Balaban, I'm a cartographer, and this is what do you call it? Right.
So he
knew what it all was. And then it's almost like a screen should have popped up with like SpongeBob, many man hours later or whatever. And then
exactly
now they got their thing all built.
Right. So, once they figure out the location, it's like, okay, now we're going to build this little base, this like figure out how we communicate with them. We got to get all this stuff set up, all this, you know,
Love that when they all realized that what they were doing, they go running to another guy's office and steal this expensive globe and roll it around. Like, that's the brilliant genius of Steven Spielberg, is that he imagines what would happen and then puts it in the film and lets you see it.
Yeah.
It's awesome.
And none of these brilliant scientists figure out that it might be a lot easier to take a piece of paper with those coordinates over to the globe rather than rolling this globe.
But it exemplifies what we talked about earlier, which is adding Spielberg adds energy. And literally,
it's excitement. Yes,
right. It's like almost like a rock song. It's like, oh, now I'm getting excited. Mm-hmm. They're doing something that I would do as a fool. Yeah. I would take this globe and roll it down the hall. So
he puts a little adrenaline into the scenes. I totally agree. And that's in the 70s, that was really weird to do. Like it's an unusual tactic in a film. Mm-hmm. Back then, things were kind of, you know, camera held still. You delivered your lines. Yeah, you just looked close to the zoomed up a close up on a guy and. You really didn't do much else when it came to common filmmaking.
We're telling a story.
And I want to, by the way, if anybody's listening who wants to be a filmmaker, I want to give you a piece of advice because Spielberg figured something out that I just love. And that is, if something is interesting in your movie and your movie is about people, people gather. They come together to around the interesting thing, and we, the viewers, pick up on that. So, like, in the air traffic control center, as this weird thing starts happening, all of these people are gathering around this one station to figure it out. Once there's a place on a highway where aliens have been flying by in the middle of the night joyriding, people start to gather. And Spielberg shows us that, and that gives you, the audience, this connection. Like, oh, wow, yeah, people are all looking in the same direction. I will, too. That's a really cool thing. Mm-hmm. And he didn't invent it, but he really does it over and over and over. And it keeps you in the film as a viewer.
Mm-hmm. It's beautiful.
Yeah, I agree with that.
So many great things. Oh, by the way, are you guys, when I was young, okay, so this movie came out in 77. I was born in 72. I did not see it until a little bit later. I think I saw it on VHS during the 80s, early 80s.
Same.
And so I was still very young then. And I had trouble dissecting the idea that Bob Balaban wasn't the same person as Richard Dreyfuss because they both had that kind of facial hair. Yeah. Kind of.
I did the same thing. You know what? I wasn't even sure this was Bob Balaban until I'm watching it. And I said to Carter, I go, oh my gosh, Carter, I think that's that dude from all those Christopher Guest movies. She goes, who? And I go,
it's the dude from Seinfeld. Yeah, the guy who runs NBC and talks him into doing a show about nothing.
Falls in love with Elaine, which is great because then Carter goes, you know what? She goes, you know what that means, Dad? And I go, what? He goes, this is Bob Balaban in a movie talking to Richard Dreyfuss. He would then go on to be in a movie where he falls in love with a character played by Julia Louise Dreyfuss.
Oh, wow.
And then we laughed and then we kept watching the movie. But yeah.
shut up.
Yeah, he doesn't. He's at a young age with all the beard. He looks like Richard Dreyfuss in a different movie. You know what I mean?
Exactly.
I don't know. You know what he looks like?
It was a very 70s look. That the bushy hair. I mean, if he would have been wearing bell bottoms with the cuffs rolled up a little bit, he wouldn't have looked any more 70s than he already did.
If you take the more bearded character of Richard Dreyfuss from Jaws and then put him up next to this Balaban character, they're kind of the same.
Yeah.
So I totally get it. And I did the same thing. I'm like, wait, who am I looking at here? Is that supposed to be him?
And that's a character, it's Balaban's character that I wish they would have had more of in the film. We could have had maybe, you know, slightly less Dreyfuss. Take out one of his freakouts, the looking at the pillow and deciding it looks like something, maybe put in a little bit more about Balaban's character and his background. And because he was fascinating, just the fact that he seemed to be, out of everybody, the person who knew the most about what was going on, even more than the French dude.
Do you think there might have been some confusion by the aliens, or like, we're looking for this guy, he kind of looks like this, and they accidentally identified Richard Dreyfuss instead?
Well, that's kind of my whole point about this. At the end of it all, what was the point of them having this in their head and their obsession? Was it to drive them to the thing? Okay. But then what? Like, did they really? They never answered why they needed him. Yeah, what's the trade? Why did they need him so bad?
I did not understand the trade, other than maybe he was most, they had been experimenting for years to find someone they could communicate with that could clearly understand the communication, and maybe Richard Dreyfuss was the most attuned. That's the reason why he got so upset. Yeah,
they realized they were never going to get that out of the kid. It's like, oh, this kid, let's give him back.
Why didn't we want this kid so much? Yeah. Get him out of here.
If you read the summaries of Spielberg talking about the film over the years and years, the aliens had mind control technology, and they were actually like directly telling people in their brains to do things
awful.
In the end, when he joins them and goes onto the ship, like you're supposed to understand that he's leaving his family, not because he's a horrible person, but because the aliens controlled his mind.
Yeah. You know? I call poo-poo.
But why the trade? Why the trade?
There is no trade. Like, at the end of the day, okay, you're right. All those people got off that had been abducted, and then they had a bunch of volunteers in red suits that got re-abducted, I guess, but in a volunteer way. I don't know.
Right, which, by the way, you notice those guys in the red suits with all their matching sunglasses look just like the way the aliens looked in V.
Yep, totally.
Oh, yeah.
They also, a couple of them look like, I can't think of his name now, Steven Seagal. There was a couple of guys that looked like Steven Seagal. And I know, and this movie's got a bunch of that. They're, like Lance Hendrickson's in this movie, but he doesn't say anything.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he doesn't say a damn word, but he's in like two or three shots where he's looking up at the alien or he's in one of the offices running around or whatever. And I had to pause it and make sure, but sure enough, he's in the credits. But he never does anything. And there's a few people like that. Carl Weathers showing up as the cop.
Oh, Carl Weathers, yeah.
If I'm making a trade, it ain't going to be for Dreyfus. It's going to be for Carl Weathers.
Yeah, what are you doing?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Give me Action Jackson.
Now, also, at the very end, did all the red suit people get on or just Dreyfus?
No, they didn't in this version.
Pick and choose, yeah.
Okay, so they chose Dreyfus. So maybe
the little kid aliens came over and said, this one, and then...
none of the ones... they only took the one who wasn't wearing sunglasses. Yeah. I love that.
And they're just molesting him as they walked him away. It's just like... little tentacle fingers everywhere.
Is this polyester? Yeah. Ooh,
that was really weird.
He's carrying some plums in his pants.
Yeah.
I'll tell you another thing Spielberg said for the 25th anniversary. So now we're in the early 2000s.
Yeah.
Spielberg said if he was starting from scratch, it would be a completely different film because he made it before he had kids, before he had a family. Mm-hmm. And, so he was like, he didn't know how jarring it would be to see Richard Dreyfuss's character just completely abandon all of his responsibilities, you know?
And that's why he came back with the more kid-friendly E.T., right?
Mm-hmm. Maybe. Well, that was a lot more family-friendly, yeah, sure.
Right.
And he doesn't like it, but he's kind of agreed that it's the same race of aliens, that the E.T. is sort of a spiritual sequel to this movie.
Well, me and Ibbot and I were talking on TMS the other day about this concept. We may have brought it up when we watched E.T., and I don't remember, but the Peter Coyote character with all the keys on his belt, there was, when I was a kid anyway, the urban legend was, and it appears to be only that, it was never confirmed, but the urban legend was that the keys guy is the grown-up kid. And that he's now on the hunt for more proof of aliens because for whatever reason, the third kind thing got, shoveled under the whatever and the government hides it. So now he's older and always on the hunt for more extraterrestrial life and that's the kid. And it kind of works. Like there's no actual hole in that theory in terms of that it couldn't be him, but.
And that's an testament to testament to Spielberg's ability to create such a unique flavor that we assume that all the worlds he has created are tied in together because he's such great singular vision kind of guy that just you can't deny it. It's a Spielberg. Well, you know, it's a Spielberg.
Yeah. But I mean, what do we think happens after the end of this film? Do we think that, all right, well, the government pretty much had this whole thing on lockup. Yeah, there are a couple civilians. We can kind of keep them under control. One of them's on the spaceship, so we don't have to worry about him. But, the mom and the kid, we're going to have to kind of witness protection program, lock them away for a while, and we're going to kind of keep this thing covered up. Or is it like this movie is the beginning of the basis of a bunch of communication between us and those aliens, and we kind of continue forward, in which case the Peter Coyote character wouldn't have to go looking for E.T. because, aliens are all over the place. And
yes, but that's why E.T. is not a full sequel. It's only a spiritual sequel because it takes place in a part of the planet where there has been no contact with aliens ever before. This movie ends with the message, humans have finally grown to the point where contact with the aliens is known. Right. It is something that is going on now.
Yeah, as sparse and desolate as Wyoming is, I've been to Devil's Tower. Plenty of towns around it that would have no problem seeing that ginormous spaceship with a city stacked on top of it.
I'll tell you what, it's funny. I got this. I'm sitting there watching this with my now 21-year-old daughter. Smart kid, but she looks at the screen and she goes, that's fake. And I go, what? I go, what's fake? I go, what do you mean that's fake? She goes, doesn't exist, that thing. And I said, what do you mean? She goes, that it's like CGI or some crappy model or something.
Right.
And I said, no, Scott, that's not, that's an actual damn place.
Scott, did you not drive your kids all around the Western United States?
Wyoming, no.
On long family vacations?
Really? Not Wyoming. And I'll tell you this.
I'll
tell you this. Now, I think this is probably fair, but I don't know if anyone else is going to agree with me here, but it feels right to me. I saw this movie when I was a kid. It's the first time I ever saw this edifice.
Yeah.
I learned in later years that it was a real place. But it's never come up in any other conversation except when I see this movie. So for me, it's almost like this genius move on their part to pick something that that's a little obscure, because it's kind of obscure. Like it.
Yeah. I wonder what this did to the tourism for Wyoming and Devil's Tower National Monument, because it had to have brought so many people. They're like, what? That thing with all the streaks on the side is a real place and the top cut off?
She was sure it was fake. She's like, that doesn't exist. I'm like, sweetie,
I'd never, being as close as I am to Wyoming, had never been there until about 5 or 6 years ago. We went to a family reunion up in northern Wyoming and decided to make a trip and do Devil's Tower and Mount Rushmore, which I'd never seen before, Crazy Horse, and do all that stuff. Deadwood. Still didn't make it to Montana. Unfortunately, we were so close.
So when you go up through the Dakotas, I'm trying to figure out what this route is, because you have to. Where's the oh geez, the pizza's here.
Oh, hello.
Oh crap, the aliens are here to take Scott.
Exactly.
No, the government is here to shut us down.
No kidding. But no, the big president's face thing. Where is that?
Mount Rushmore.
South Dakota. So you went
up and around and over. Okay. Yeah, I can see
it. And never made it to North Dakota either. Like we did South Dakota, did like the Black Hills, did Mount Rushmore, did
Crazy
Horse.
You didn't make it to North Dakota? You missed nothing.
I know I didn't, but hey, I still have to visit those two states over there. That's it.
Yeah, right. Brian
Montana,
wants to get all
North
50.
Dakota, and that's it.
He wants all 50 and he's done.
Got to catch them all.
Yeah, got to get them all. It's like Pokemon. I mean, think about it. Why would a grown man still be playing Pokemon? Because he's into catching them all. I get it.
Exactly. I have to collect all 50 states. It's not like I've even bought like a spoon or a commemorative plate or a little magnet showing that state from each one of these places. I just have to have been in each one.
Here's the thing. I don't know if I believe it. There's actually two of these trivia bits I'm not sure I believe, but let's just throw them out there and see what we think.
Yeah.
Says the film is shown, this film is shown every night at the Devil's Tower KOA campground up there at the National Park there, thereby making it the most screened film of all time, because every night it's shown, including tonight, every night.
I don't see how that could have been true. I see how it could be true now. I don't see how it could have been true in prior years, because film would not accept that kind of abuse.
Oh, no, no.
Well,
you'd have to have multiple prints.
No, here it is. I'm on the official KOA.com/campground/Devil's Tower. And it says, enjoy the nightly hayride through this historic Campstool Ranch, one of the oldest ranches in Wyoming. The movie Close Encounters of the Third Kind was filmed on site in 1976 and is shown nightly at the campground.
Oh, wow.
So it is still being shown. And this KOA offers a full-service restaurant, an extensive gift shop, and a sweet shop that features legendary fudge and hand-dipped ice cream.
Yeah, made by Richard Dreyfuss. That's right.
touched by Richard Dreyfuss.
He licks each piece himself.
Yeah,
he shapes each piece into a Devil's Tower monument.
I will guarantee that over at Disneyland, there's a film that predates this one that's shown every day.
Hey, it could have been Captain EO, but they stopped showing that.
Yeah, Captain EO got put to sleep.
It's the movie you watch before the Hall of Presidents.
Mm. Oh, yeah. They still show. Oh, man, I need to get to the Hall of Presidents.
Last time I went.
Yeah. Yeah,
I need to see it now that it's got the big animatronic modern presence.
By the way, I was at Disneyland a week ago, and it was and love the Enchanted Tiki Room, but it's time to update the soundtrack. Just saying.
Yeah, oh, sure. I kind of agree. The last time I was there for full Disneyland treatment, which is like September a year ago, they were working on the Hall of Presidents. Something was being done, and we couldn't go in. And I was pissed because I was super into
We're
that.
Putting in Trump.
That's probably what it was.
That's what they did. They put in a little animatronic prump.
Prump. But the idea that they had to shut the whole damn thing down to p- put a new president in, I guess makes sense, but it annoyed me. And I was like, all right.
Listen, my wires are very huge. I have lots of wires. The best wires.
The best wires. And also they had something else. Oh, Space Mountain was shut down, which was a huge bummer.
No, that's crap.
Yeah.
That is crap. You know, it's because they do it right around this time every year because they take out they put in ghosts for Halloween. Right. And then they have to de-theme it and then get it ready.
Right. So it would have been end of September. So that makes sense. Yep. Yeah.
And we were there a couple of days before Randy went. And I looked ahead on the thing because it said, you know, if you look at the app and you pick the day you're going, it's going to say, we know these rides are going to be unavailable. And one of them was the Matterhorn and another one was Space Mountain. I was so bummed. Well, as we were walking by Space Mountain, we were on our way over to the... what used to be the little circular wheel of progress or whatever it's called, yes. And was Stark Technologies for a while. Now it's Launch Bay and it's all Star Wars stuff.
Oh yeah.
As we were walking over there, we saw Space Mountain open line 30 minutes. And we're like, oh, we're doing this. Let's go. And so we got in line. We found out that it was only open for an hour that day because they wanted to test things after the de-theming.
Oh,
and
no. That's always super. Right
No, thank you. Yeah, I don't want to be a test subject on your ride.
You don't want to be Space Mountain beta?
No.
Come on. It's not like those things ever leave the tracks.
I don't know, dude.
No.
I don't
That's what I thought before I rode the Peter Pan ride Disney World.
Oh, good Lord. All they're doing is just taking off the little ghosty things that float around on the ceiling.
But freaking Jasper from Team 2 sat down to smoke a smoke a fat one, and he leaned in and bent something you didn't know about. I don't know, dude.
If they need to test it, there's a possibility of bad. So no,
I'd be much more worried about all the ash, human ash remains that you get when you splash down in Pirates of the Caribbean.
I know, that's
everybody dumping their loved ones.
Yeah, that's a thing. Okay, here's another one where I think is a lie, but only Brian Ibbett can confirm it, okay?
I know what you're going to say,
Stanley Kubrick says he was so impressed with Cary Guffey's performance, that's the little kid, played the four-year-old kid, that he wanted him for the role of Danny Torrance in The Shining. Confirm or deny? You tried out for that role, right?
I tried out for that role, and I was one of the last. I was in the running the last few. My mom says I was in the running like the last three kids. But I always thought it was like the last, 8 or 10. Danny Goffey or Cam Got, what's his name? What's the kid?
Cary
Guffey.
Yeah.
Cary Guffey.
He would have been way too young for that role because he was five when he.
Four or five. He was
born. He was born in 72, same year as me. So
right. He was actually four. This was filmed in 76, came out in 77. Right. So he was four when they filmed it.
The Shining
would have been.
That was later.
He would have only been like seven or eight when they were filming that.
Danny Torrance needed to be 10, 11?
He could have pulled it off. 11. He could have played older. Toys.
Yeah, he might have been able to play older. I mean, Dreyfus even played older
than me.
Dreyfus played older. He's born in 47, but in this movie, they asked when he was born. He said 44. They always do that. I don't even know why. Why is that a thing? Why don't you just say when you were born? Who cares?
Can we also talk about casting Dreyfus? Because. We talk about this a lot on Film Sack. It's a thing we return to, like who did they almost have in this role and what a different movie it would have been. Spoilers for this one, everybody.
Yeah,
right. Freaking everybody.
Right. Yeah.
But Steve McQueen was apparently the person that Spielberg wrote it for, and McQueen liked it, but he didn't feel like he was the right person for it. He didn't feel like he had the emotional range.
He said something about how he couldn't make himself cry on camera, things like that. Yeah.
So then we just get into Dustin Hoffman, Al Pacino, Gene Hackman, Jack Nicholson, and it's like, okay, let's just list all the famous people.
No, Gene Hackman would have enjoyed Jack awesome. Nicholson. Though. I would have liked Jack Nicholson. I would have loved Gene Hackman. The story with Hackman is that it was all a go, and then he was having a major breakup with his wife and ugly divorce, and
that would have been perfect to use that for the role.
I mean, yeah,
right,
kinda.
Exactly. I mean, I'm experiencing this now.
I love him, so I would have.
By the way, if you go and look online at pictures of Cary Guffey and what he looks like now, he kind of disappeared. He retired in 1985 from acting and went on to do other things, but he looks like just a receding hairline version
of that kid,
of himself as a little kid.
He also looks, Carter said, pointed out, he looks a little like Frank Burns, just a little bit. Larry Linville.
Oh, a little bit. Oh, so you guys looked at older pictures. I think the kid, it's funny because if you shave the kid's head, he would look like one of those gray aliens. He's got the big eyes, the little slit for a mouth. I mean, he looked like he would have fit in perfectly with those gray aliens.
I assume
aliens.
Those kids, the aliens were all kids too, right? They had to be.
There's, yeah there were actually kids. Not yeah, we didn't
not little
yeah.
people. Rubber suits. Yeah. Mm-hmm. As far as I could tell. He's just
girls at that. He said Spielberg said that he preferred girls because they were more
graceful.
Graceful, there you go.
Well, they okay. are. Little boys at that age are kind of dicks, to be honest. I mean, boys are boys.
I would have loved to see it come running down the thing.
Yeah.
Farting in their rubber suits.
Yeah, farting in their suits. Dude, I just farted in my suit
being
again.
Stupid.
Yes, exactly. You are exactly right. And it's not to say that girls don't want to have fun, in the famous words of...
Yeah.
But, you know...
not yet. It's not yet. The 80s yet.
I mean, there's something about... I can just tell you just from experience, there's just a difference, and I can't really tell you why. Mm-hmm. And also, when I was a kid and I was that age, I was a total doofus, and every girl I knew my age was like way more mature than me. Like yeah. they had it going on. They got grades going on. They had worried about school.
I want to say this is a gross characterization, because I've met plenty of young boys and plenty of young girls who have different grace levels. I don't think it's only attuned
you're
to
right.
one sex.
You're right, but I think that if you're casting for 50 alien right. kids. And
the
you
ratio
have the
may
choice,
be more in your favor.
Yeah, if you have the choice, you're going to go with a bunch of... I would go with a bunch of girls, because I would trust right. them to misbehave less. And mm-hmm. they would call that... What I don't know what that is. Is that sexist? Is that reverse sexism? I don't know what that is, but it's true.
No, I think mostly for just a pretty... You know, girls.
I agree with you, and obviously Spielberg did, but it's telling that they cast a three-year-old boy for this primary role. And it's amazing the performance that they managed to capture. You really believe this kid is experiencing what you're seeing.
They also called him one take carry, because apparently he was really good at just nailing it the first time. And they would rarely take second, third takes. Or if they did, they felt like they kind of wasted it, because he would get it, whatever they needed out of him.
How hard is it? All right, look over here and go, toys. Okay, I could do that.
Yeah, it seems simple enough. I guess it's harder than...
They could have called me one take Ibbit if I would have been on The Shining for that same reason. It's like, all right, we need you to drive your big wheel through the hallways.
But Ibbit's not bitter.
Your brush with fame was so close.
It was to come many years later in the form of Coverville and TMS and Film Sack.
There you go. I don't know what that other kid's doing, but I'm thinking you're right. I don't know. What's he doing now? What's the kid?
He's doing nothing. The kid from The Shining is doing nothing. He was in
The
Great Gatsby.
Let's not. He's not doing anything. He's not sitting on his couch. He's living life.
He's not acting anymore. I'll say
there
that.
You go.
Okay. There we go.
All right.
There
that's fine. He's that's not fine, a famous actor. Yeah. He didn't go full. Who's a kid actor that went on to be a giant adult actor?
Jason Gordon-Levitt.
No, he's not a jerk.
No, he's not.
I'm sorry, did you say? Oh, no, no. Were you specifically asking for ones that became jerks?
No. I'm saying Dunaway jumping throat on that one.
Which one was a jerk? Well, okay.
Misunderstood. I thought you said something about being an asshole.
No, I was laughing because his name isn't Jason Gordon-Levitt. His name is...
Joseph Gordon-Levitt.
But you were asking about went on to fame, right? Like Drew Barrymore?
Yeah, there you go. Drew Barrymore, another Spielberg graduating class.
And handled it so well, really. Yeah. I mean, she had a bump. She had a huge bump.
She was snorting cocaine at 12. Like, yes, she had a giant bump. She had a
Look how she recovered.
No, she did fine. Look, I think what she has accomplished since is very impressive. But if you look at that dip, that takes out people, and she made it through, and it's impressive she made it through, because she had a piece of business.
Elijah Wood is your
yeah, there's your guy. He kind of had his own thing going on. Sure, we're gonna watch on Thanksgiving. We're watching all our Thanksgiving movies, and everyone says, "Well, wait, isn't Planes, Trains, and Automobiles the only Thanksgiving movie?" And I would say, "No.
Oh God, no. There's a ton.
There's a whole bunch, and one of them
for the holidays is a good one.
Yeah, The Family Stone's pretty good." If you're into that, what else? That's my wife's pick, but I like
is that the one with the Sid Chivas in the Family Stone. Or is that a different one?
No, I don't remember, but it's got Dermot McRoney in it from our movie.
No, we love that guy. He's great.
But
he needs some chaw right now.
He needs chaw.
Big old branch of chaw. He
needs all the chaw. But like the movie Avalon is this old movie, and there's a huge Thanksgiving part in it, so I think of it as a Thanksgiving movie. But young Elijah Wood in it. He's like five. Right. Yeah.
During Thanksgiving, I always find every Bob's Burgers Thanksgiving special because that's always
they're so good. That show figured out a way to make Thanksgiving episodes as cool as Christmas or Halloween or any of the others usually that these shows do. Somehow and Thanksgiving is great.
Because Bob cares. It's so wonderful. You know, next week we're going to get to see a new episode of Bob's Burgers. Wait, tomorrow we're going to get to see a new episode of Bob's Burgers with Bob really trying hard to make Thanksgiving great again. Yeah. And it's like,
it's his Christmas. That's,
slavishly, lovingly trying to make, it feels genuine. I totally agree. That one where the turkeys kept showing up in the toilets, I was so frustrated. I was so frustrated for him. I felt so bad for him. Anyway, Bob's Burgers, catch it. Fox. All right.
Yes.
I'm going to take a quick second here and thank our friends at Bombfell. Bombfell is an online personal styling service for men. I'm one of those. Hey, I'm a man. And they help you find the right clothes for you. They're personalized just for you, in fact. You sign up online. You complete a very simple questionnaire. You're then matched up one-on-one with a dedicated personal stylist. This part was much easier than I would have expected. And then they handpick every piece, and they help you do that. Your stylist will email you a preview of their selections, and you have time. You got 48 hours to make any changes or cancel it altogether. You're in total control the entire time. Afterwards, Bombfell will ship you the selected clothes, and you'll have 7 days to decide and only pay for what you want to keep. So if you got, like me, ordered a whole set of new stuff, and you're like, I like everything but the socks, you can send that back with free shipping both ways. So it's very flexible that way, and it doesn't matter what you're doing there. But anyway, very, very flexible. You can receive clothes every 1, 2, or 3 months, and you can pause the service or cancel at any time. They leave that all up to you. Clothing is shipped straight to your door. No need to spend hours shopping at the store. And now with every shipment, the more you keep, the more you save. Keep 2 items, you get 10% off. Keep 3 items, you get 15% off. Keep 4-plus items, 20% off. That's crazy. That's like a sale every time you do it. Sign-up process was super easy. The quiz was easy. All that stuff was just a piece of cake. Not hard at all. And the items that I picked, I liked a lot. I got this awesome blue button-down and some khakis. Oh, I look good in these. I clean up nice when I need to. But opening that box was great, trying everything on. It was like Christmas every morning. I mean, honestly, when you're a guy like me, now you appreciate clothes for Christmas. And so getting a box in the mail and opening it like it's Christmas Day is nice. Really nice quality pieces. I got a belt that I think is fantastic. Anyway, we have a special offer for our listeners and just for the show. For $25 off your first purchase, go to bombfell.com/filmsack. That's, here's how it's spelled, bombfell.com/filmsack. Once again, bombfell.com/filmsack for $25 off your first purchase. And we thank them again for supporting the show. It's awesome stuff. Go check it out. Here's the most insane trivia that I found. You ready for this one? This is a good one. One early concept for interpreting the aliens included an orangutan on roller skates. The idea did not work because the orangutan became too frightened, and the second that its roller skates touched the ground,
arms flailing about.
Yeah, I can't even imagine. Like it's gonna look like an alien. Like it's gonna look like that new mascot for whatever team was.
Greedy. I am not getting on that ship. It's look at those guys.
Terrible
no
idea. What an awful, awful idea. But
yeah,
love it though. It's
this says they did it. I can't confirm it, but that's what it says. All right. What else? Did you guys find anything that you thought I thought was gross?
Oh,
Bruce parts. That's a good question.
There aren't a lot, actually. I'll tell you that right now. And in fact, the thing I picked is probably not going to get picked by any of you guys. But
bringing trash, stinky garbage back into your house to build.
That's pretty bad. I should have probably put that on my list. I have two.
That trope of jerking the trash from the street. That's always fun.
Yeah.
There were two moments I was like, wow, Scott would not like to be in this. And so the first is when the little kid wakes up and comes out and the refrigerator has just been emptied onto the floor. It's like, oh, come on. Seriously?
He's totally getting blamed for that, too.
Yeah. I don't think Scott could handle Dreyfus kissing Terry Garr. I think that's the thing that grossed him out.
No, that was okay. He's kind of
you're saying it's gross for Terry Garr.
I think
Scott associates himself as Terry Garr.
No, he's a semi-handsome dude at this age. He's fine. He's fine. That didn't bother me. Yeah. But it is Richard Dreyfuss related. Okay, so there were two of them. And the one that doesn't really that gross, it just annoyed me. And I was like, please freaking wrench your hands off. He spent like 20 minutes walking around with freaking shaving cream on his hands. Dude, wash your hands. There's all this exposition, and you could have had your hands washed 50 times by now. Go wash them off. And he's laying on the bed holding his hands up, still got goop all over him. Half his face is covered. He never washes those damn hands. Okay, so that was one. But the worst for me was the very end-ish before he gets on the ship and the door opens and the light's really bright, but he's staring right into it. You can see all the way up Richard Dreyfuss's nose, just right up in there. Just a big, hairy pit of despair. So
the other thing I made note of is the scene, which, and admittedly, all of these scenes are too long. Spielberg was really loving scenes where the aliens are somehow shaking things and causing, like, physical objects to move. They never really explain. Like, I wish he had stuck with a scientific explanation, like they can make metal objects move because they're, like, Magneto or something. Mm-hmm. But anyway, the scene where he's first encountering them and he's in his truck and they put the truck on a big tilt-a-whirl and kept the camera stationary, so they turn the truck over and all the stuff in the truck flies around and hits him in the face and stuff. There was so much stuff in that truck. Who has a library of papers in their truck? It was ridiculous.
I don't think it was that ridiculous. I grew up during these times, and people used to use their dashboards to store all this paperwork because we weren't in digital age. So there was so much paper, and if you didn't throw it away, I've seen so many trucks this.
This is my dad. So many work trucks. 100% my dad. 100%. Right. Everything.
And if it's
in
a work truck, for sure.
Yeah.
But and
my dad's truck was always teeming with that stuff. Dusty, disgusting. Right. There's like a half-eaten freaking burger somewhere.
There's going to be a plastic coffee mug from a convenience store that's got a handle on the side and one of those red flip-top lids.
Yeah.
That's going to be somewhere in your work truck, and that's going to dump out all over the place too. Like coffee where the cream is like settled and congealed onto one side.
How much did you guys want a city map to pull down from your visor? I was just like,
Oh my gosh.
You know what I want? I want a little Frankenstein model for my bedroom whose pants fall down and his face turns red.
That is cool. There's a lot of cool toys in this.
Spielberg also good at bringing those out in movies. He's great at digging out cool
circle
stuff.
Back around for just a second what Randy said about didn't understand the purpose of the movement and no explanation of the movement of objects when the spaceships were around, like the railroad.
The lack of gravity and stuff.
Right. And the railroad sign.
Oh, things. Sure.
Flying around. I was glad they didn't explain it because I'm assuming this technology I wouldn't understand. And it also played to Dreyfuss's moment of doubt later on when the helicopter shows up and the stop sign is flipping around. You're like, okay, so we have devices that we understand, and we understand why they're moving. Maybe there'd be something that the aliens would not have, and it might also give you a moment of pause and doubt that maybe you're just crazy.
Yeah, that stuff didn't bother me. In fact, I attributed it to
like magnetic fields or something in the air from the spaceship,
and it was almost always metal stuff. Now her house was a little different, like. Did a thing come in from the ship and dig through the fridge and dump it all ET style and then leave? I don't know. Maybe. Right. Did it just open and explode because of some metal thing? Was the vent, chimney?
The unscrews.
Like, was that something unscrewing them or was it magnetic? Right. Again, like, none of that felt.
It's the refrigerator always takes a beating in supernatural and sci-fi films. Ghostbusters when Zool shows up tries to eat Dana.
No, fridges are mistreated in Hollywood, dude.
Eggs usually are a thing that blow up and explode.
Yeah.
Soda pops.
Yeah, cans. What else? That's pretty much it.
So like Randy said, trophies.
Yeah, trophies.
And yes. And like there's a side trope here, control your kids, which bugs the hell out of me because I've had a kid. I know what you do, and that is when they're able to run around and let themselves out of the house, you board the place up like it's a prison. And this is such an incompetent mom. And it bugged me that she was being portrayed this way, because it's like at some point you realize, oh, my kid's a runner. You tie yourself. Yeah, you tie yourself to them, and that's that. And she didn't do that. And then, like, the fourth time he runs away, he manages to, you know, get abducted. I'm just like, why are you doing this as character? Like, this movie is mean to this mom.
Was this more a reality of the 70s? Because I was often able to escape my parents.
It was a different time for that time. They just let you go. You didn't have a phone. You didn't have any of that. Yeah. You just went. You were out. Yeah,
I'm with you. Little kids a little more, maybe. Maybe back then they just kind of like, I'll have another one.
Too much. I can't imagine there was ever a time when I was ambulatory but too young to like be reasoned with, and my parents were just like, he sleeps in his own room over there while I'm completely passed out drunk with the TV on, and like he could just come and go. I mean, we live out in the country. What could happen? Yeah. Like, that would never have happened.
Yeah, this is a little extreme. I think
different
for this
time.
Kid.
Different time in the '70s.
Sure,
yeah.
But this.
I remember
this
walking to elementary school, and I was like, second or third grade, and
Like
my such mom a long was, distance my mom was crossing two major streets.
Mm-hmm. Right, my mom was always taking a nap. Look. I was always, I don't know if it was the alcohol or what, but she was always taking a nap.
And there's a theory going around. My sister talked about this with me off air the other day. There's this theory going around that the reason people are more interested in making sure their kids are constantly okay in our modern age is because of technologies that make it impossible for you to have plausible deniability if something bad happens. Hmm. So if your kid runs out into the woods, back in the day, it'd be like, well, what else am I supposed to do? These days, they got a tracker on them. They got a phone in their pocket that tells you where they're at all the time. Like, you got all these reasons why in court it wouldn't hold up. You know,
you put them on a leash when you take them to the mall.
Right, right.
Story. Hey, if you lost a kid there in the '70s, everybody just went shrug.
Yeah. Oh well, we'll make more.
I really find that the theory that availability of birth control is what has changed parenting attitudes makes a lot of sense. The fact is, you are not likely to get married at 18 and then have 12 kids, and it's like totally acceptable culturally for you to lose three or four of them along the way.
It's not wrong.
So that you can lose a couple,
right? Mm-hmm. We're in a spot in now that I think it was a lot more frequent to lose siblings.
Oh, it was. People would have 12 kids because someone had to carry the farm on, and four of them were going to die of diphtheria. The other one was going to fall off a cliff. The other one was going to sat on by a cow.
We weren't exactly working the farms in the '70s, but
before that, like that meant, and then you know they have people like my wife comes from a huge family. Her parents they all grew up in Mississippi, but she has not that that matters, I guess, but she has. Let's see.
What are you saying, Scott?
I want to say there were 10 total of them, of the kids, and two were adopted. Or no, three. So there's that. But that's still a ton of kids. And that to them seemed like what you should do, because your goal is to, you know, leave no stone unturned, kind of, or whatever. And you want to have as much backup as you can. And these days, like her mother was almost offended. Not, I shouldn't say almost. She was offended when we stopped at three. She thinks that's not enough.
Right.
And I remember saying to her, well, you know, what's right for you isn't the right for us, blah, blah, blah. But she didn't seem to care. There was this time where I had a niece sat on my knee. We got this niece who's adopted. My wife's sister, Sarah, adopted a daughter. And she sat on my knee one day when she was very little, looked at me, and because I'm not her dad, she starts to cry. That's what little kids do. Babies do that at that age. And she turns to me, my mother-in-law turns to me and goes, you know what that is, don't you? And I go, what is it? She goes, that's because she was just in the before life, and she knows that you should be having more kids, and she's upset at you because you're stopping to have kids.
Oh, my gosh, that is hilarious.
She told me that, and I looked at her and went, oh, my gosh, are you freaking kidding me? And now this kind of stuff, it's not that it's ended. She hasn't stopped doing this sort of thing, but now I have to treat it as a joke, or else I'll just lose my mind. So now when she'll hug me and then say something in my ear, something judgmental, because she'll do that, I'll go, I'm being hug judged. I'll say it out loud and she'll get mad and hit me on the arm. But it's a much better relationship now because I just don't take it. Even in the '70s, I think there was just a different approach to when you started having kids, how many you would have, when you'd quit. if one
and
run off.
You got to remember also, it was a new age for the independent woman. Not that no one ever was an independent woman without a husband before then. It was just becoming much more common and trying to work those jobs, because Terry Garr's character was like, I'm not getting a job. So they were very old school, even for that time, of ideas. And so this new girl, she's a working mom. We assume that she's working a lot, and she's got to get up early and trying to raise a kid. And it's hard when all that stuff is coming at you.
Yep. And she was really good in this. I thought that actress was great.
I thought she did a great job. Yeah. I thought
she had very little to say, but just
from a movie standpoint, Spielberg is trying to create tension. And this kid creates a lot of tension, because you're like, oh my God, just get the kid.
She's really that kid's really into Boston University, though. Do you notice that?
He really is. Yeah, he's an alumni.
Yeah, really into it, wearing that shirt and whatnot.
Yeah. And I think it tells you something that he cries when the aliens leave, but he seems more than happy when he's leaving his mom.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Bye, mom. Ha, ha, ha. Runs through the woods. Exactly.
Sucked. Which is sleep, fall asleep actually, in your Daisy Dukes.
That actually really rang true to me. A little kid, especially an only child, is trying to kill himself at all times.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, kind of. And they don't have backup. They don't have, you know, a sibling on their shoulder going, now. Like, let's see, Ibbet, you're an only kid. Did you ever feel like you were just loose out in the everything? And you're just,
I totally did, but yeah. I didn't feel like I was out there trying to kill myself. But I did feel like I was
hellion,
not untouchable, indestructible. I would, you know, go and do jumps with my dirt bike off of things that probably are way too big for me to do jumps off of, and climbing on things I shouldn't have, and spending way too much time up on rocks or in trees or things like that.
Yeah, those all sound really good to me right now.
You're a poor mom.
Well, speaking of poor moms, be poor no more, because we're going to do clips now. And there aren't a ton. It's kind of a movie without a lot of dumb dialogue. It's kind of just matter-of-fact stuff, and none of it's too over the top. So it's not a ton this week, but it's enough to share. For example, this is what Richard Dreyfuss sounds like when he's scared by a sudden flashlight turning on. Okay, so this is the sound he makes when you turn a flashlight on. There you go. There's that.
There were a lot of people scared by lights in this film. Like when all the lights are going off in the gas stations and the McDonald's, you hear like four or five people going, "Hey, lights!"
Yep, yep.
Yeah, you know that, but that's real.
Is it?
Have you ever been in a public place and the lights go out?
Yes.
There's always like this.
I have.
I don't yell, "Hey, lights!"
Yeah.
Hey, lights! Hey, lights!
Yeah. No one says, "Hey, lights." Nobody says,
"Hey, lights." Yeah.
Spielberg claims that he based the whole scene of Dreyfuss putting everybody in the car at 4 in the morning and rushing out to see a thing. He says that was based on a childhood experience. There was a meteor shower or something, and his parents threw him and his siblings in the car.
I personally had that experience multiple times.
We've done it to my kids. Never happened to me, but we did it a couple of times with the kids where I can't remember what they were, but we shoved them in the car and took them to a thing. And I remember them liking it.
I was awakened multiple times to look at the moon. That was a thing as a kid.
You're not going to believe it.
Yeah, like there was like, you know, like a lunar eclipse or whatever, and my bedtime was real early.
Yeah,
and I would get awakened an hour later, and
I still do this every time I see a funny cat video. Kids, get up!
Yeah, it's only cat videos here. Though. Yeah, you must be the most annoying.
I'm gonna get you
in
the car. We're gonna drive around the block. Then I'm gonna come back, and we're gonna go look at this video.
Yeah, the most annoying dad award goes to you. All right, here's okay. So Dreyfuss says that this is better than a thing.
Come on, get up, both. Come on. It's better than Goofy Golf.
It's better than Goofy Golf.
Better than Goofy Golf.
Also, the audio in this movie is not great, by the way.
Yeah, it's blaring.
It's also very tinny. And
it's very harsh.
Yeah, I'm not impressed with that. But again, it's like his second big feature, and I mean, who knows? Here's that song.
Go
ahead.
Did any of us have a Goofy Golf course nearby?
No.
Well, we had putt-putt. I mean, the same kind of thing, right?
I had golf. We had mini golf and stuff, but I never heard of a branding one called Goofy.
We didn't have Goofy Golf, but it was, I imagine, just all different names for the same thing.
Did you guys have Goofy Golf, Randy?
No, absolutely.
Oh. Maybe it didn't exist.
I grew up in South Texas, man. I remember when we got McDonald's. Like, seriously, the idea of something like a properly branded Goofy Golf being within 500 miles is crazy.
We just play with sticks and knock the ball inside a deer carcass. That's how we did it. Here's that song that we all know and love. They never explain how the Hindu people knew the tune.
Yeah. They said that it came down and it spoke to them. So basically, one of the ships was hovered over them, I guess, and did the thing. It was actually
kind of,
a really
aliens
great
are
looking,
kind of dicks. They're just kind of manipulating everybody.
Like, yeah, that's the idea. Kind of. Yeah.
But they didn't explain how the Indian people were able to make that weird edited cut after they do the first three notes before they do the last two.
Yeah. That's a really good point. I wrote repeats. I don't know what this is. Here you go.
Wait 60 seconds and the whole doggone thing repeats.
Oh, I made a fart one. I made a fart one.
I didn't think you could do it. You made it better.
I forgot to. Good job. I forgot I did
I
that.
I loved how that guy was explaining what was happening and the other guy was like, all right, sure, whatever.
Yeah, he just showed up in a suit. Like, yeah.
Very realistic.
Very weird. Here's a flying saucer explanation.
Ladies and gentlemen. This is a flying saucer.
And then later explains that it's not.
Psych! It was my kid in this dinner plate.
Yeah. Yeah. Those guys were jerks. Here's Santa Claus line.
Now, there are all kinds of ideas that would be fun to believe in. Mental telepathy. Time travel. Immortality. Even Santa Claus.
Jeez, that guy's a real harsh.
Least realistic thing about the film is how often someone gets to speak and a whole crowd of people don't interrupt them.
Yep.
It's amazing.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. That never happens in real life.
It was the 70s.
By the way, my dad's generation for sure would say not mental telepathy. He would say mental. And that guy says mental. Mental telepathy. They couldn't say mental.
I saw Bigfoot once.
Yeah.
By mental.
Dude, that Bigfoot guy was great.
Oh, yeah.
What was the sign he was holding up? It said, be friendly.
Y'all come on back.
Stop a while and be friendly.
Yeah.
Or something like that. Stop and be friendly.
Stop and be friendly.
I want a tattoo written in his poor handwriting.
Yes. Those weird block letters. Tons of block letters. Yeah.
Also, I didn't
One of the best fonts in any movie ever, Close Encounters. And then we get this guy with the sign.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, for sure. All right, here's a line I don't understand very much.
What I need is something so scary it'll clear 300 square miles of every living Christian soul.
What about all the ones that aren't Christians?
Yeah.
What if there's what if you got a Hindu down there at the camp? He's just going to sit there? Go, I don't know why all these Christians are leaving. I hate that line.
I don't understand, Scott. Why didn't you add the fart there?
Right?
Oh, my gosh. It's so dumb. I don't like it.
Play the game with the fart. I know you got it.
I don't.
Yeah,
know.
You got a button.
I always
have
farts, but I don't want to go find it. Yeah, okay, right. Here you go. There you go. The Scooby fart.
Close enough. I can use my imagination.
Yeah. Here's Santa. No, sorry. This is the final one. This is the tones that we all know and love.
Play the pop tones.
So that was created by John Williams.
John Williams.
After multiple attempts to create it. And I guess it just came down to Spielberg going, that's it. That's the one. I like it.
Yeah.
100 variations, apparently.
And I do love the back and forth between the NASA or the scientists and the big spaceship when doing the tuba sound of burp, 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 like it's going out of control responding.
It was really cool. And again, from the perspective of a younger person who hasn't seen this movie before, Carter was enraptured by that. She thought that was so cool. Mm-hmm. She's like, this isn't even using like amazing special effects technology or anything, but I'm completely in on this. I just love how this feels and looks. And
bit is the best part of the movie. When we watched this, I don't think I'd seen it since I'd seen it in theaters in the 70s and 80s, but I completely forgot about the whole, airplane, the disappearing airplanes thing. Mm-hmm. I forgot about all the Indian stuff, the hand signals, all that. And it wasn't until basically the only part of the movie I remember is Richard Dreyfuss putting together mashed potato versions.
Yeah, do it.
Okay, now that's funny you say that, because I only remembered him doing a giant mashed potato thing and forgotten that that was just a small version. So while we're watching the mashed potato scene, I'm like, oh, I thought that was bigger. And then it's like
I could have swore I remembered the potato bigger because I was totally convinced. I'm like, why did Terry Garr make those many potatoes?
Yeah,
but it was just a normal amount of potatoes.
Yeah, it was.
All right, so Roy Neary goes up on the spaceship. He gets a little tour. they bring him back to Earth probably at some point, but he won't have aged because that's the way things work, apparently. Mm-hmm. Does he go back to his house and then just say, all right, I guess I've got to shovel all this mud out?
Oh, assuming yeah. Oh, ever, my gosh. Yeah.
Assuming that he comes back. I don't know that we're.
No. I'm worried about Terry Garr's got rights to the house. She's going to have to come back and deal with that.
Oh, she's going to come back. Yeah, maybe he could send some of the little kid aliens to go there with a bunch of shovels and help her out a little bit.
Yeah.
Like, he said 20, little troop of 20 of these things with shovels. And
yeah, that's a great idea. I hadn't thought about that.
Merry maids.
Here, when alien he, Mary this maids. Is what happened. I have exclusive audio. This is when his character leaves the ship. He's now spent some time with the aliens. They've fully anal probed him, and he's come out. And these are the first words out of his mouth. Oh, no, that's not it. Shoot.
That's great.
Wait a minute. That wasn't it. Gosh dang it. I ruined my own joke. Here it is.
It's about Peter.
All right. That doesn't work as well now that I've screwed it up. So well done, Scott. Good job. And now time for this. It's the Film Sack Checklist. After a while, everything looks like a phallic mountain in Wyoming. Yes. Mm-hmm. Check, true. Rather. Terry Garr, still crush-worthy in 2018? Check. What neighbor raises geese? It's more of a question, but check.
The nosy neighbor?
Yeah, the nosy neighbor with her geese and her hair blower.
So far away from her house, too.
Yeah. Direct connections, we have a number of them. The Enterprise swinging around his train room. That was cool. And there was a Klingon ship as well.
And a Klingon ship, too. Yeah.
Those are great. Terry Garr, she plays Ronnie Neary in TOS. She played Gary Seven's receptionist. Roberta Lincoln in Assignment Earth was the episode. Ralph McQuarrie did conceptual art for this movie, and he was the conceptual artist for 1977's abandoned Star Trek Planet of the Titans project.
I like that even better.
And Voyage Home. He also did all that Star Wars stuff. Mike Peed, great name. It's literally P-E-E-D. Mike Peed, and then he did animation photography. He's not even having a connection. Daryl just put him in because he has a funny name. Yeah, thanks, Daryl. You're great. Gregory Jean was a chief model maker in, I don't know what TMP is. What's TMP?
Chief model maker.
TMPs.
Temp? Oh, the motion picture.
Oh, Star Trek, the motion picture. You need to put an S in front of that. Anyway, constructed various interior scenes of V'ger, stuff like that. And in TOS played a dude twice, and then in TNG played somebody once.
Space, am I right?
Yeah, space. Right? Space is pretty great. I'd give it a soundtrack grade. I'd give it an A for awesome. I loved it. It's one of my favorite ones from John Williams. It was great. Mm-hmm. This was kind of like the time where everybody knew that this collaboration and the future of John Williams was going to be pretty incredible. Mm-hmm. So,
and it will always remind me of Robin Williams, who was a very famous stand-up comedian at the time, performing the score for this movie in the middle of his act, like with just his mouth. And it just makes me so happy that's a memory.
Cool. I don't even know about that. Amazing. That sounds great. Was that, so this would have been around that era, around that time?
Mm. Yeah.
Hold on. Robin Williams.
Close Encounters.
Ooh, if there's video of that, that would be really super cool.
Here we go. Oh, you know what it is? It's all defaulting back to Robin, or it's even though I typed Robin, it's all going John because it doesn't. Right. Yeah, I can't.
Or
find
Robbie
it.
Williams.
Someone out there will find it. Oh my gosh, Robbie Williams. Who's that? Who's Robbie Williams? Help me now.
He's a musician, UK musician.
Oh yeah, right. He does the X Factor guy. He's one of the hosts on there. Right?
Yes, he was a member of Take That, or one of the British boy bands, and kind of went off and did his own thing, and was way more popular than the British boy band that he left.
And he's coming to Vegas for some reason. I guess people like him.
Sure.
Let's get to the Twitter post. This is where you guys sum it up in 280 characters or less. Let's begin with Randy Jordan.
Close Encounters of the Third Kind. A pleasurable look at every aspect of humanity with admittedly repetitive music that seems to go on forever and ends with people standing around just quietly watching as you intimately join a group of strangers, just like Saturday Night at Ebbets House.
That's right.
Saturday Night at Ebbets House.
If only there was if there was an emoji for Saturday Night at Ebbets House, you could use that and save characters.
Yeah.
I packed it in. I got it all in. It took some editing to get that in there.
Someone talk to the Unicode people and let's get that Ebbet emoji in there.
Yeah. It's like the Saturday Night at Ebbets House emoji.
I'm in it. Or in it to win it. All right. We Brian Dunaway.
Close Encounters of the Third Kind. It's like Halloween for grown-ups. No. It's like driving while mapping. No. Mm. It's better than Goofy Golf. Yeah, that's it.
There you go.
Like, better than Goofy Golf.
Probably.
Thanks, Jimmy Dreyfuss.
Jimmy Dreyfuss. Nice. Finally, Brian Ibbett.
All right. So I have a couple because I was afraid Randy was going to use my first one.
Randy.
Okay.
But here's my first one. Close Encounters of the Third Kind. Did I ever tell you about the time I was a keyboardist for NASA?
Nice.
And just in case he used that one or did some form of that in his opening, my other one was Close Encounters of the Third Kind. Hey, you like UFOs. I like UFOs. My wife doesn't like UFOs. Let's make out.
Yeah, on this rock, on this mountain. You know what? I forgot about the keyboard guy. He should not get short shrift here. They literally had a dude who could just play that over and over and very fast. Yeah.
Just a keyboardist for NASA. Like, what do you do? Well, on the small chance that we ever need somebody who can play a Casio, that's my job. Yep. That's what I do.
Yep. And I swear those keyboards back in the day could repeat stuff. So I don't know why they didn't just do that. Just
but he had to improvise a little bit. Like, there were times when he had to kind of go off chart.
He looked really nervous,
Before they push the button that says, let's put it on autopilot, or let's put it on, you know, the computer's figured out their level of communication. We'll just let it take over.
And he was so nervous and like jittery and sweaty. And then when the thing suddenly pulled forward, he goes like barreling off the back of it. Like that dude was in it to win it.
It's great.
Alternate titles. Oh, these were just handed to me. This movie was almost called Mr. Holland's Mashed Potato Opus. That almost happened. It's crazy, right? And then this was this one that almost made it, but then they finally settled on Close Encounters of the Third Kind. It was almost Near Run-Ins of the Less Than Fourth Kind. It just didn't roll off the tongue in the same way.
Not quite as ambiguous either.
No. Turns out not. All right, I got an email from Andy who wrote in. These emails come to us at filmsack@gmail.com. You're encouraged to send them yourself, those who are listening to the show. Hey, Sackers. I just listened to the Young Guns episode. My parents were lax on movie ratings and allowed me to watch things on VHS at age 9. All I remember from that viewing was the crazy peyote scene and how awesome it was to be thrown out of a window in a chest. Also, wanted to share my all-star cast. All right, so this is what he wants for a new version.
Okay, the reboot. This is who would be in the reboot.
And it's really good, you guys. Like, straight up, Andy is onto something. I think the lesson we're learning here is let your kids watch rated R stuff when they're kids, because then they have great ideas when they're older. All right, here you go. Tom Holland. Perfect. Bring him in. Yes.
Okay. Yep.
Jesse Plemons. Jesse Plemons should be in everything. Joe Keery. It's the kid from
Matt Damon, you mean?
Yeah. Joe Keery from Stranger Things. I don't know which kid that is. Or if that's a kid. That'd is it a kid? I don't know who that is.
I'm looking it up because I want to know. It's definitely not the kid missing the two front teeth.
No, it's somebody else. I don't know who it is. Taylor Lautner. Who's Taylor Lautner? Help me with that. Taylor Lautner. No? Nothing?
Lautner.
Okay, we're looking at
him. I got Taylor Lautner. I've seen him in a bunch
of stuff like Twilight.
Oh, it's the Wolf guy. No, I'm now off the reservation with this guy. I don't
Joe Keery, by the way, Joe Keery, Stranger Things, he's the older kid who had the mullet, like the... Okay. The total douchebag kid.
Yeah. Oh, okay. That's a that would fit. Yeah, all right. Yeah, Nicholas Hoult from he was Beast from X-Men.
Holt. Yeah.
Yeah. I thought it was Hoult. No, Holt.
Always thought Holt, but sure, whatever.
Hoult. You're probably right. It doesn't matter. The important thing is he was in the greatest film ever made, Mad Max: Fury Road. Will Poulter from The Maze Runner. So this is pretty good. He thinks Hugh Laurie would be great as Tungstall. And Terry O'Quinn could come back and replay Alex. Just my thoughts. Easily. Love the show. Keep on sacking. Yeah. Well, thank you, Andy. It's fine suggestions.
Taylor Lautner, Twilight, right.
I'd be into a Young Guns reboot. I really would. And I'd be fine if somebody did it. Maybe I'm just in the mood for that Buster Scruggs thing that came out last night. I'm gonna watch it tonight.
Looks so good.
I'm very excited. Have you watched any of that?
Tonight, I'll watch it. And a reminder for people, there are a lot of people who still think this is a series. It's not. It's a movie. It was supposed to be a mini series of like, you know, 6 episodes or something. And then the Coen brothers changed their mind for some reason and went just a single film. But what I'm hearing so far from people who know me, they think I'm going to eat this up. So I'm stoked to watch that tonight. Maybe next week I'll tell you what I thought of it. And then you all probably watch it too. It's on Netflix and in theaters. So do what you want to do. Our next movie will be
16 Candles.
Wow.
Can you believe it? Is that our second John Hughes or third? How many John Hughes movies have we done?
Third?
Breakfast Club.
We've had one more, though, didn't we? Or did we?
Why am I not? We didn't do Planes, Trains.
We're all rushing to filmsackstats.com.
Yeah.
I know. We haven't done Planes, Trains, and Automobiles.
No. I think we turned it down because it's just too good.
Yeah. Too hard to make fun of.
Yeah. Let's see. John Hughes.
Well, yep.
We haven't done a Home Alone.
We've only done the Breakfast Club.
Dutch.
We didn't do Dutch.
We didn't do Dutch. Nope. We wanted to
We've
do Dutch.
We've only done the Breakfast Club.
Have we not done Dutch?
Nope. No Dutch. Nope.
Oh.
We've done nothing with Al from Married with Children in it.
God, I could have sworn. Oh, that was, I guess, a recommendal. Sometimes I overlap our recommendals and our film sack films.
Don't do that.
I know. I won't. No more. No more will I do that.
Actually, Film Sack Stats is behind. They've got the latest episode, Van Helsing. That was a while ago. Get on it. Let's do this thing for free that we love and that you just don't have any reason to do. Go do it. All right.
What is our genre for 16 Candles? Because I love, that's the most interesting part of Film Sack Stats for me is that we primarily do action and sci-fi and thrillers and adventure.
Yeah.
Dunaway, did you just say it was the Ringwald?
Coming of age film.
He called it the Ringwald genre.
Dramedy?
Dramedy?
Yeah, sure.
Is it though? I don't know. Coming of age. Nah.
Yeah.
It's a defies description because John Hughes movies are kind of in their own hole, you know?
Yeah. I mean, what would you describe Breakfast Club? What category does Breakfast Club on Film Sack Stouts fall into?
Stouts.
John Hughes.
It's going to be my new brewery.
Right.
Stouts.
It's the Hughes genre, dude. That's it.
Yeah. Right. Yep. Exactly.
Yeah. And I would remind people the greatest marriage of John Hughes style and Quentin Tarantino style is the 1997 fantastic film Gross Point Blank, which everyone should watch 1,000 times over. It's in my top 5 movies of all time.
You're going to get people drunk by mentioning Gross Point Blank and Mad Max Fury Road in the same episode of Film Sack.
Hey, look, they got...
You know there's a drinking game. There has to be a drinking game.
There has to be. And it's on them for their terrible life choice. It's on them. anyway, that's 401. We'll give you the 401 on 16 Candles this weekend. Now, here's the interesting bit. We're going to do it live on the Coverthon that Brian Ibbett runs every year, where he earns money for Alzheimer's research, which is a fantastic cause. And a good excuse for us to all get in there on a Friday and knock it out live. And we'll put it up, of course, like it always is on a podcast. That doesn't change anything. We did this last year and I think the year before. So nothing new or strange. But anything else you want to say about it, Brian?
Yeah, I mean, you can find out more information by going to coverville.com/coverthon. That's where I put all the info about it. Our bit, our film sec bit, is going to be at 10 a.m. Mountain Time. So that's noon on the East Coast and 9 a.m. on the West Coast.
So it's awesome. The second hour of
it is the second hour. Exactly. So Tina and I get in there. We do our stuff. We talk about why we're doing this and get the ball rolling. I play a couple Milli Vanilli covers, a Steely Dan set, whatever. Mm-hmm. And then we roll right into Film Sack.
Sounds great. So I'm looking forward to it.
I love your examples of songs, man. That's right.
It's not only great.
The only reason I think of Steely Dan is because they have a song. They do Black Friday, a song called Black Friday. Oh, it's more about the depression deal. Getting up at 3 a.m. to buy microwaves at Best Buy.
Yeah. Also, very good point that it is literally Black Friday, meaning Thanksgiving the day before, and we at least in the U.S. we hope everyone has a fantastic Thanksgiving. We will not talk to you until after that. But we hope you have a good one and you eat a lot of food and do nice things for other people and be thankful for things. That's next week. That's 401. And we'll be live. Coverville.com/live.
Yeah. Yeah. What are we giving thanks for this week? I'm giving thanks for mobile games because everybody loves them.
Yeah. Everyone has a phone and everyone loves
mobile
games.
Is that snark?
Yeah, it's a little. I sense a little snark. I sense a little. Just a little bit.
I can't imagine why you would bring that up.
Yeah,
and why you would talk about
it. Weird. I'm thankful for. this is kind of related, but I've been able to do nothing but slavishly want to play Diablo 3 since I got home from BlizzCon, and I don't really have a good explanation for why, except for that still remains one of my favorite games of all time. And I just can come back to it when I'm feeling it. And right now I'm feeling it. And I'm running like multiple riffs a day and just cranking. I love that game. So there's that. I'm thankful for Diablo 3.
I'm going to pander to the audience and say I'm thankful for our listeners who have listened to 400 episodes of this crap.
Aww. Yeah, that's super sweet. Wow. Look how far we've come since Kroll, you guys.
I'm thankful for gravy. Mm-hmm. I'm thankful for stuffing. I'm thankful for mashed potatoes.
Yeah.
No matter what they mean.
Yeah.
What shape you form them in.
They all sound good.
It would
good.
Be really cool to hear from a listener or two or whoever who have legit listened to all 400 episodes. Like now, like if you're hearing me right now and you're like, oh wow, I've listened to all 400 episodes, maybe shoot us an email because that would be cool.
Yeah, we'd love to hear that. And I know there are a bunch of you. I'm sure of it. In fact, I know one personally who's for sure in that category. So if you guys are want to share your sort of lifetime achievement award here, we'd love to pimp you on the show. Yeah, heck yeah, that's great. We'll do that next week as well. But you had to have watched all of these movies. That's the other trick. It can't be just listen to us. You have to watch every movie.
Dude, I haven't even watched all these movies. Sometimes I just look at Wikipedia.
Yeah, you just come in here and fake it. I see.
Hey, if you're listening to this episode and you're thinking about going to watch Close Encounters, and you're like, oh, this is going to be too hard. If you go to YouTube and look up movie clips, lots of times the top 10 clips from a lot of these movies we watch are right there. And you can just get the highlights. And we usually talk about the highlights as well as other
things. Yeah, the cliff notes if you're lazy.
Do that for Young Guns. Don't do that for Close Encounters of the Third Kind.
Yeah.
This is one that's worth seeing.
Yeah, this one is worth seeing. And we try to bring the heat. Whatever that means. I don't even know what that means.
We bring the funk and we bring the noise.
And the noise. Yeah. Heat, funk, and noise. All three together at last.
All three.
Speaking of all three of you and me, that's four of us. We'll be back next week with another Film Sack. Of course, filmsack.com is our website. Film Sack on Twitter if you want to find us there. You can also email us, filmsack@gmail.com, like Andy did and like all of you should. Also, leave us reviews wherever you get your podcasts. Google Play, iTunes, or I guess it's Apple Podcasts now, wherever, Spotify. Review those things. Let us know what you think. And yeah, you heard me. Spotify has all the shows, so that includes Film Sack. That's going to do it for us, for me, for Brian, and for Randy. We'll see you next time. All right. That worked out good. This show is part of the Frog Pants Network.
Frog Pants Network.
Get more shows like this at frogpants.com.
Like a taco?